At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mark, true or false? True or false? Every single president that's come to the UK for a state visit has had a public-facing meeting apart from Trump. True or false?
I suspect that's probably true.
Liz?
I think it's probably true.
It's false.
No!
I'd like to guess what other president did not get a public-facing meeting at any point.
Oh, Bush, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. 0-0. Question two. Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, was in Congress this week, and he claimed there was no credible evidence for people trafficking from the Epstein case. Liz, true or false?
True.
And Mark?
I'm going to go with false, because I think he avoided most tricky questions using deflection.
It's true. He said there's no credible evidence, despite the photo of Andrew and Virginia Roberts. And apparently, according to Congress, several Congress people, including Republicans, one Republican congresswoman was in tears having listened to the testimony, and several congressmen came out, or Congress people, sorry, came out and said there are at least 20 very powerful people on our list. So Patel is saying no to that. That's not evidence enough. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Question three. Liz, Donald Trump gave the king a golf club from Mar-a-Lago saying, make GB great again.
Oh, did he? But you're asking me if he did, if it's true or false. Oh, it probably is true. Oh, I don't know, but I'm saying it probably is true because it's so ghastly. It probably is true. Trump could do the most ghastliest things in the world.
Mark.
Yep, I'm going with true as well. That's got Trump tackiness written all over it.
It's actually make Britain ghastly again.
It's false. But I love how you both thought it was real. That's phenomenal. Mark, Reform this week received a donation. It's claimed, not this week, but this year, that Reform received a donation for £100,000 from a company that's winding up and has been caught out for avoiding paying tax.
I'm going to say false, because I probably would have heard about that, and I haven't. But I have been very busy this week, so...
Plenty
There's
on,
my caveat.
Yeah. Liz?
Oh, these are really tricky questions this week, Al. And I've been busy, and I haven't kept on top of everything. I think I'm probably... Well, no, I'm going to do the opposite, so that you know, we can hedge the bets. I'll say true.
It's true. More wow. Tax dodging weirdness from the Reform Party.
Why we need to take dark money out of politics.
I feel a speech coming on there, Mark.
But it hasn't had much publicity. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, well, I think that
says it all.
The fundamental problem.
Let's get into it. Welcome, everyone, to the Sunday Roast. And we have a special guest this week, Open Britain's Mark Kieran. Mark, can you please introduce yourself to everyone?
I can, yep. Mark Kieran, I am CEO of Open Britain, an organisation which focuses on making democracy work for everybody. I'm also a director of Fair Votes UK, which is the organisation behind the biggest APPG in Parliament, the APPG for Fair Elections.
Can you tell our audience what APPG stands for?
All Party Parliamentary Group. These are independent groups, cross-party, MPs and peers focused on a particular agenda. And the APPG for Fair Elections agenda is to change the voting system from first past the post to a fairer, more proportional system, to take dark money out of politics, and to combat disinformation in public debate.
I knew there was a speech coming. And my wonderful co-host, Liz, please introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Liz Webster, and I am the founder of Save British Farming, and I go around trying to educate people about why we need our own British food, because it's better for our security. It's also better for our health.
I love that, because you both obviously have a connection with the Trump visit this week, and one's taking dark money out and one's taking dark meat out of the British system. Mark, how did you find the state visit this week? Were you there?
Oh, it was fantastic. I enjoyed every minute of it.
What was your highlight moment then?
There were lots of them. I mean, that was a joke, obviously. I found the whole thing really quite depressing. I'm an old civil servant, and I sort of understand the nuts and bolts of government, and sometimes governments need to do things that the rest of us, you know, would feel uncomfortable with. International diplomacy is a particular environment for that. So I do understand the need to sort of, you know, play up to this guy. But I just think he is so grotesque in terms of what he stands for and then what he actually does on the basis of what he stands for, that I found virtually the whole thing really distasteful. I think I recognize the argument for, you know, flattering the guy, playing to his ego, giving him ceremonial pomp. I understand all of that. But you can't detach that from the very real signals that it sends out, that Britain is endorsing a man like this. And, you know, on the march on Wednesday, organized by the Stop Trump Coalition, I spoke to lots of people, and that was their view. You know, what are we doing giving this guy legitimacy by giving him this platform? Just an appalling thing in my view. Open Britain, you know, when this visit was announced, we kind of thought it was coming, but we drew a red line at having him have the honour, the honour of addressing Parliament inside Parliament. And so we established quite a successful petition and got into communication with the Speaker of the Commons. And I'm very glad to say that he wasn't given that honour. I think that would have been a real disaster.
Is it down to the Speaker then, who has the final say about who addresses Parliament?
It's a murky process, but and I say it's murky because there are things written down on paper, which when push comes to shove, you know, all sorts of things come in. For example, once Starmer had given Trump that envelope in the Oval Office saying the King had invited him for a state visit, lots of people said, "Oh, we need to immediately cancel this state visit." Now, you know, asking Starmer to go against the instructions of the King, it just isn't going to happen. That's you know, not the way it works. There is a process by which the government will advise the King what to do. The King will pronounce, I mean, on the back of advice from all of his courtiers. Parliament then has to be asked, and the Speaker is one of the important people who is asked for their view on it. Now, you know, inside government, most of these conversations are rehearsed and checked out and, you know, gone through before anything is said in public. And that's what we were playing to. We wanted to get into the Speaker's head that the public were not up for this. And he needed to think very carefully about just sort of, you know, rolling over when asked.
It did feel quite nice knowing that he was pretty much locked in a castle, which is probably the closest we'll ever see the bastard in prison, to be honest. Which was quite nice, because that's why I was like, he didn't have a single public engagement. And yet, I think there was an image of Barack Obama meeting people from the public outside Stonehenge. They just happened to be walking by, and he came over and had a conversation. Yeah. I just don't see Trump doing anything like that. And I don't think it would have been possible. It was interesting as well to see that Bush is the only one that didn't have that public meet, because the Iraq war was just so horrific. Well, well done. Thank you for doing that. That was fucking brilliant. It was nice to see some sort of pushback instead of just being walked over with red carpet.
You know, for you and your viewers, go on to YouTube and search for Obama's address inside Westminster Hall. And you, first of all, he opens with a great, you can fast forward through the introductions. They're all a bit dry. Burko does a good job, but, you know, get to Obama. He opens with a fantastic joke, which shows that he's completely happy and relaxed there. And then listen to the first 15, 20 minutes of his speech. you will find yourself sitting back thinking, what the hell have we got these days in international politics? This is what it should be like. You know, whether you agree with his politics or not, there's a sort of presence to the man. There's a high level of thinking that just is completely absent these days.
It was interesting as well, because just on that note of how he was addressing it and how Obama dealt with Trump when he was questioning him about his birth certificate, how Obama dealt with the press. And there was just this moment this week as well where Trump was asked a question by an Australian journalist, which was a fair question. What's going on with all the finances within your family? Do you have anything to say to that? And he said, everything's fine. I'm now going to have a word with your prime minister about you because I don't like your question. And I was almost disappointed because I would have been expecting an Australian to tell him to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
I was slightly disappointed by that. And then he told
me. Yeah, but I'm sure the Australian people were saying that. I mean, it's not going to have done Trump any favours in Australia. They're hardly people that take things lying down.
Yeah, that was like, wow, he's trying to influence everyone's press. Go on, Liz, how did you find state visit? Any highlights?
Any highlights? I mean, low lights, probably, I would say. Lights that were very bright, but very, very dark. I think seeing that huge dining area with such opulence and wealth was just so distasteful when the country is being forced to deal with no growth and stagnancy and real cuts to our public services when the wealthiest and most powerful are there all hobnobbing. Ed Balls, who's supposedly in the media holding power to account, there, you know, hobnobbing with this coterie of power was also incredibly sick-making because it is meaning that we really have no proper accountability. We have no free press. We are caught in some form of horrible oligarchy. And how do we get out? Some people say the only way to get out of oligarchy is revolution. But we seem to be going closer to that reality faster by the day. And that is what it smelt like to me. And that's what it looked like at every step of the way. And I'm not someone that has ever really fallen in love with politicians. Nobody. I've always been taking them at this feeling of like, what are you doing? And I've always been sceptical of every single prime minister since I've been awake to politics. And I can honestly say that I have never really felt so unsafe as I do under Keir Starmer. And it's not that, I'm sure if I met him on a personal level, I'm sure he's a nice enough person. But I think that he's able to be manipulated by this opulence and wealth instead of perhaps someone like Cameron, who comes from that kind of background. I feel that Starmer is just he's in awe of it. And that means that he's putting us in a very difficult position. So I feel nothing but anger and depression around our current government. And I had such high hopes for it last year. I also try to encourage people to vote for them. But the Labour Party might still have power to take back control and get rid of this right-wing cabal, which are, you know, making us feel very trapped at the moment. And that's really where I am. So perhaps seeing this thing that it is, this Brexit reality of the rich are free to do as they like and everybody else is trapped in a deep well, perhaps it will cause a revolution, a quiet revolution. I really hope so. And that's where my energies are going to continue to build.
Do you feel less safe than compared to Boris Johnson and COVID? And well, look, you feel least safe with Starmer.
I really, you know, when the coalition came in 2010, that's really when I actually sort of thought, oh, I don't know about this. I feel there's some change. I felt a change, a change of values. And then, when Cameron went and Theresa May took over, I wasn't keen on her either. And I felt that she was selling us out. And then when it went to Boris Johnson, it was a very dark moment. And I thought it was going to be our darkest moment. And he completely fell apart and people saw him for what he was and his popularity went in the bin. But I can honestly say now that at least the Conservative Party, the MPs, did have a backbone and push back against what was going on. And they eventually turfed him out. Truss was a bit of a sort of a momentary striking of a match which took off and then somebody blew it out, thank God. And then Sunak, you know, I felt uncomfortable with Sunak. I felt that he was the, you know, being such a wealthy person, I felt that he was never going to have empathy for what the country needs. But now I see that actually I would prefer to go back to Rishi. I can't believe I'm saying this. I would prefer to go back to Rishi Sunak than what we've got at
Would
the
you
moment. With
really?
a cabinet of sycophants, with the new Home Secretary, who is even worse than Suella Braverman. You know, these things really matter to me. Words and intentions, I hear, I don't really see personalities. I look at the law as a safety net. I don't look at it as anything that's cumbersome. I understand the need for personal safety around rights. And when you've got governments ramping up that they want to steal those rights from us, I'm scared of that. I'm scared of that for all of us. I'm scared of authoritarianism. And so for me, that ramping up of authoritarianism has been, you know, I can see the trajectory since 2010 in particular. I mean, I could go back to the Iraq war decision, but, you know, it certainly started accelerating from 2010.
I find it's interesting you say that because obviously I feel like the right to protest has been completely eroded. Like,
Yeah.
Not My King guys got arrested before they committed a crime, which is thought police territory. That is 1984 classic. That is other. There's another movie with Tom Cruise where they catch you before you commit a crime, can't think what it's called. But you're like, wow. Then.
Minority Report.
Minority Report, yeah, which is a classic book as well, isn't it? Before it was a movie. And then you've got this very interesting flip around because I asked you about highlights. I thought the Led by Donkeys projection
Oh,
onto Windsor Castle was
yeah, definitely.
incredible. That what? Well, no, sorry, I wasn't thinking about the activism. I was just thinking about the coach and horses of Trump's parade. But oh God, absolutely. Those images were so inspirational. Absolutely brilliant.
They got kudos in the States from a lot of YouTube influencers, not so much by the mainstream media, I don't think. I don't think Fox is going to be reporting on
Well, one
that.
of the things, Al, that we've talked about the fact that they kept Trump away from ordinary people, and that the room, the banquet, was full of, you know, global business titans. You know, these things are not unconnected. The problem with our sort of political system, and particularly our voting system, is that we end up, as we do right now, with a government that's in power with all the power and a minority of public support. And so, whenever you have a system where the government is there and it ought to be getting propped up and supported by a majority of ordinary people, they will listen to ordinary people. They will value what they say. They will be feeling accountable to those people. But we don't. And so, one of the effects of that is that ordinary people, you know, they stop their membership, they stop contributing to fundraisers. And politics is an expensive business these days. So naturally, these people are going to be looking at that and saying, do we go out and try and persuade 1 million people to give us a quid? Or do we just go to that one bloke and convince him to give us 1 million quid? And that just ends up being where they go. So that mechanism that Liz mentioned is just going to get tighter and tighter. Because when you go and ask one of these guys for 1 million quid, he says, well, maybe, but what are you going to do for me? Because they're business people. They do transactional stuff. And guess what? The things that they ask for are not necessarily in the interests of ordinary people in on the factory floor and whatever.
No, generally not, are they? And Obama's campaign was quite interesting for that because they went the other direction. Obviously, they did get large donations, but there was definitely a fundraising program that was set up on the ground. God.
Sorry, large donations in the context of, you know, an overall system where there are also lots of large numbers of small donations. That's not necessarily a problem as long as you've got the right people taking, you know, the decisions on who you take the money from and what strings might be attached to it. But when it's, you know, in the absence of that's a significant problem because that is oligarchy. That's people with power and people with money reinforcing each other at every turn.
I've just finished writing another book called The Case for the EU. And in it, I put a couple of scenarios where I show how a bad person can infiltrate into the British system. And part of it is that. And the loopholes are still there. They've not been fixed since Brexit. So to my current knowledge, you can go through Northern Ireland, put a donation through Northern Ireland, and then they can dump that into a UK political
That's right.
without being checked. And there was the case of the 250,000 that was put into the Metro to have a front page cover put up.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's not being solved. Mm. Like they won't deal with these major issues for some reason. And it boggles my mind. It's like, do you want democracy? Do you want it to be corrupt? And it seems like they want it to be corrupt, as you said. Because unless you've been Chris Wiley and the other whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica, apologies for getting his name, but both of them are like screaming from the rooftop, you've got a corrupt system. Hmm. No one's done anything about it. It's still there and it's still corruptible and it's continuing. I mean,
there is hope. I mean, we all need hope. Hmm. And there is hope that the ECHR case brought by Caroline Lucas, Ben Bradshaw and yes. Alan Smith. And we should know next month, I think, if they really? Actually are going to get an appeal and get a hearing in the Grand Chamber. And if they don't get a hearing, then we can all, as citizens, write to the, and complain to the EU Commission about the fact that there is a missing decision with Brexit. There was never a proper decree nisi, as I call it. We went straight to the absolute. And so if the ECHR snuff out that case, then we do have another gateway through to go through to the EU complaint system. And particularly people like Mark Kieran, who's also got an Irish passport, lucky person. They are people that we need. Anyone across this continent with an EU passport, and I'm calling the European continent, anyone across the world actually with an EU passport can write a complaint about what is going on with Brexit Britain to the EU Commission. And not a lot of people don't understand this. And it's something that we probably should have done before Brexit happened.
Could you explain what the nisi point is? I think that's how you described it.
So Gina Miller and others took Brexit to court when Theresa May said she was going to use the Henry VIII powers to make the decision to leave. The referendum was advisory, and so it didn't make a decision. And you can't make a decision which is advisory, a vote. You can't magic that into law. Well, you shouldn't be able to, but we did. And it was magic because the court case that came was actually preemptive. Normally, judicial review can only happen after something has happened. Mm. So it's something hard to challenge. But because of the exposure of the referendum, the courts decided to rule on this before the government did anything, which in itself, I think, was a mistake. And so that court case made people feel as if it was OK for then a three-line bill to come out of that Supreme Court hearing, which was a lot to do with Panic, Lord Panic and his representations. And that three-line bill, which everybody thought was Parliament deciding on Brexit, only asked for Theresa May to notify a decision which still was never made. To this day, that decision was never made. Because it actually ended up rolling on to 2019 and Boris Johnson's microwave Brexit deal, which they sort of said, well, that's it. The public's voted for this. 43% voted for Johnson to give him a huge majority. Brexit's done. But it is no different to me getting divorced and going straight to absolute without the nisi and sorting out what happens with the house, the kids, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And that is why we're in a mess now, because that decision around what happens to everybody was never made properly. And it's always worth comparing this with, and this should resonate with Mark, because he was actually in the Cabinet Office when this went through, I think, the rights to hunt foxes. That was removed as a right. It took Parliament from beginning to end 7 years to actually remove the right to hunt foxes. Wow. And when you consider that all of the rights that we had from being in the European Union were removed in a matter of seconds. So actually, the Brexit decision from the referendum was magicked into law. And in my view, and I hope that if ever it does get into the European courts, it will be proved that it was actually not, it is still illegal. It's Brexit is still illegal because the proper foundations for Brexit were never actually sorted out in law.
Do you think there should have been a second referendum vote, like Northern Ireland and Ireland had over the Good Friday Agreement?
The short answer, Ali, Open Britain, I think some of your viewers will know, was the official Remain side of the referendum. And when the referendum was lost, it spent the next few years trying to make that case. You know, this decision has been made, but it's not clear that it was made with a full understanding of the implications of Brexit for all the sort of reasons that Liz has just outlined. And so the People's Vote campaign, you know, I don't know if people remember, there were a million people sort of mobilized on the streets to try and get that, but it was painted as, you know, the establishment going against the will of the people and all of that, and that too was sort of killed by Boris Johnson's success at the 2019 election. You know, I am a political campaigner. I understand politics. I understand how people receive messages, but I'm also a former civil servant, and so I understand that, you know, your first instinct on something may be, oh, that's an attractive thing, we should do that as soon as possible. Mm. But, you know, the thing that's at the root of all of these complaints you often hear from government ministers, that civil servants are a sort of negative force on progress and that they get in the way and all of that, it's not that they're getting in the way for some, you know, some nefarious reason. They're just saying, mate, we're the ones who actually have to make this stuff work, from the idea, through the structures, through the regulatory systems, to the guidance that's issued to practitioners, to how it will actually be how it will be implemented at the grassroots level. And I'm telling you, this bit doesn't work.
The implementation or the way they try to implement
Liz it? Liz mentioned that I was in the Cabinet Office. I was Principal Private Secretary in the Cabinet Office during Blair's second term, and a lot of what Blair was doing was looking at public services and trying to get the main public services working better. And we had these people in the Cabinet Office with, you know, brains the size of two planets, coming up with fantastic theory about how things should actually work. And then when they get to the, you know, the guy that manages the benefit center in Gateshead or whatever, is say, this isn't going to work. Give me 10 minutes and I'll explain to you why this isn't going to work. You have people in charge of the governance of hospitals saying, yeah, I read that and I sort of nod. In theory, that's great, but we don't live in a theoretical world. We live in a practical world. So let me just, you know, introduce some realism into this. And that process is often seen as a negative process, but, you know, it's proper planning. That old military thing, you know, what is it? Piss poor planning and all that, you know. And that's sadly why we end up with politics that it takes up a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of resources, and then doesn't actually deliver the benefits that people were led to believe they would. So, you know, Brexit, you can't get anything much more fundamental than Brexit. It touches just about every aspect of our life. And I think the nature of that debate and the sort of rigor and the robustness or lack of in that debate is horrific, and, you know, a lesson for us all to learn as we make big decisions about who we put in charge of our country in the next few years.
It's definitely up there, isn't it? It's funny when you were saying like planning, it'd be like saying, well, we'll just invade Germany and take out Hitler and then it's done, and just go and do it. We voted for it, so go and do that. And it's like, yeah, there's a logistics side here.
Few other issues.
Feed an army.
But I mean, you use that example. The Iraq War was it's accepted even by those who were the most vigorous proponents of that war, that we just didn't do the work up front to work out what happens after you topple Saddam. And, you know, that look how that ended up.
Part of the same thing of decisions for chaos, decisions that happen and cause chaos. That is the only byproduct of it. And there has never been a proper sort of line drawn in the sand, so to say, or perhaps we need to stop making these bad decisions. And at the top of that, and I have to mention this because it comes back to the banquet, Murdoch, the man who hacked a dead girl's phone, has never been held to account for all of the poison that he's injected into the world. I mean, not just here, sat in that banquet, never, ever, ever held to account. And the position that he held over Brexit is just incredible. And the Iraq War, of course. And
And it
this is what I don't understand. Why, when you're really, most people in Britain disagree with the Iraq War. They see it as being wrong. They blame Tony Blair. Nobody blames Murdoch, who is there behind pulling the strings. And the same thing with Brexit. The Leveson inquiry never completed. And here we are with Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's right-hand man, sat next to Rupert Murdoch in that banquet. Oh, you know, I don't know how we escape from this.
Did anyone
I mean,
else find it weird
sorry.
as well? Just a quick point, and I'll throw and throwing it straight back to both of you. Did anyone else find it a bit weird that Murdoch is being sued by Trump because of the image of which I didn't twig? It's an image of a young girl that he's drawn. It's not a woman. Someone pointed it out to me the other day, and then his signature, I only twigged the other day, is pubic hair, which is fucking weird. I'd only twigged when I saw it on the Led by Donkeys thing. I was like, oh my God, that's so fucked. And then
But it's
obviously
all
the
fake,
text.
Al. It was created by the Democrats. It's all a hoax.
But then Mandelson is all real, right? Yeah, because
Yeah.
that makes total fucking
But he
sense.
doesn't. Trump doesn't know who Mandelson is, even though he's been standing in the Oval
Apart
Office.
from when he was saying how great a guy he was standing next to him on fucking camera, you're just like, this is. The press in this country really need a rocket up their backside. They really do. Like, there's so many easy wins, and I have no idea. And they'd sell more news if they did it properly. So it makes you wonder what on earth is going on. But
It's not about selling news, it's about controlling the narrative.
that's it, isn't it? And that's why you have a limited number of papers. That's why you had a limited number of news stations. And this is why I quite like YouTube, because actually it's democratized quite a lot, and it means like. We were going to talk about Jimmy Kimmel getting kicked off. Well, he can go start up a YouTube channel. He'll be huge. And no one will be able to control him. Like maybe YouTube, but I can't, I wonder if Trump would be able to influence YouTube and Google in that way. I wonder.
I
But
think Kimmel will be on Substack before the end of the day, I would imagine.
I find it, yes, no doubt. It was just so. Murdoch's released that image and though that the transcripts and everything else about what's been said with Trump between Trump and Epstein. But then he was invited to the dinner, but Sadiq Khan was banned specifically by Trump. And you're going, what the f-? And again, no one in the press brought that up. Like
And
he's
also, of
suing
course,
one
we're
guy and
free to
he's.
make our own decisions, aren't we, Al, thanks to Brexit?
Then you had
Do you know on
Susan
that?
Hall. I'll just finish on this.
Yeah,
Sorry.
go on. Sorry, Al.
Susan Hall tweeted, I'd rather have Trump around
Yeah.
than Khan. And you're like, I reposted back and was like, so shock, you prefer an American rapist over your own Brit. Just left it at that, just boom. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? How is a British woman saying she'd rather have an American rapist than our own London mayor? It's like, are you fucked in the head or something? Sorry, go ahead, Mark.
No, I was just going to say, I'm going to be watching with interest this suing of the New York Times. The paperwork that was submitted the other day, it apparently includes some small but really, really important details that suggest that this is a personal legal action. And that's really important because the Supreme Court judgment last year, was it? Earlier this year, maybe, gave his presidential actions an enormous amount of latitude, impunity pretty much. But things that he does as an individual are legally materially different. And I think that's perhaps a significant strategic misstep if that's where he has gone. And that leaves him open to the Murdoch essentially saying, the New York Times saying, okay, we're going to do a deposition now. We need you. You've made this case against us. It is our right now to sit you down and put you on camera and ask you some probing questions. You have not done this with your presidential hat on, so you can't go crying to the Supreme Court. Sit over on the other side of that desk and either answer these questions, brackets, that won't be good, will it, for you, will it? Or sit there and just plead the fifth or whatever it is that he ends up doing. So I'm watching that with interest, see how that develops.
Do you
Is it
think the Murdochs have really want to bring Trump down and put Vance in. I mean, obviously they brought him to the cot here to the Cotswolds recently.
Well, we.
And that's where they're all gathering. You know, it seems to be a bit of a hot house around here of them. But and obviously with the with Murdoch passing on to his son Lachlan, who is the most right wing of them.
I mean, I heard rumors that Murdoch did have a private meeting with Vance out of the spotlight where the succession was discussed.
Wow, like a monarchy. That's
Well, a
wild.
realization that as vice president, you know, if the president has to disappear for whatever reason, then you know, that's the next, that's the person who takes the hot seat. So, you know, even that
Oh.
those conversations are taking place is a recognition that Trump either might be, you know, done as far as a man like Murdoch would sort of consider it, or that he served his purpose and he just needs to be peeled off now and thrown in the bin and
Yeah.
move on to the next guy who's going to be his most useful puppet.
Are we? It's funny how you use the word peel because I was just thinking orange peel. Sorry,
Not
really bad.
intentional, I have to say,
But
but well done.
do you mean succession with Trump Vance coming in now or when Trump steps down as president? Because there was a
No, well,
very
before full
odd.
term, I think.
Sorry. Yeah.
Before full term, before he's served his full term, I think.
Because there was a video of him when his cheek sort of started sloping to the left. Did you guys catch that?
No.
Very odd. Like the type of thing that you see in those adverts for someone having a stroke. And it sort of just drooped quite significantly. And he does look significantly more frail. He doesn't look out of it, but he does look more frail than compared to 4 years ago when you look at him
He's quite
after.
old. I mean, he's
Yeah.
80, isn't he? Coming up 80.
Yeah.
And he's
So
very, very overweight, which, you know, which won't help.
Nope. And he doesn't have the greatest of diets, does he, from what
No.
we've seen?
And I think he's probably in for a shock in the midterms next year. I think that's, you know, that's a time horizon that's going to really have an impact on how the public see him. The unsophisticated people within the MAGA support base will just ask questions. You know, this Epstein thing is already a wedge issue, a self-inflicted wedge issue. He comes out, he, I mean, the danger, there's a reason why political discourse has usually been moderate because, you know, whenever you paint the other side as appalling enemies of the people, who, monsters, and they beat you at the election, at the ballot box, people say, well, whoa, hang on. Are these the most incompetent people in the world? And they've just beaten us.
Well, it's
you know,
rigged. It's rigged. It's
well,
rigged.
rigged, rigged, rigged.
It's rigged. It's the
But
only
I think there will be a
explanation.
moment of truth when those midterms come around. And I suspect power players like Murdoch will be positioning themselves now for to keep their options open around then.
Yeah,
You know.
but Vance isn't going to get the same amount of popularity as Trump,
No,
is
no,
he?
no, no.
There's just no way. I mean, but they certainly do seem to be approaching this as a form of a relay race. That's what it, I mean, we've got it here, haven't we, from one to the other.
And you know, the other thing to remember about Trump is he's an absolute narcissist. He's very transactional, and if it looks like you know, he's done and life is, you know, becoming intolerable, he's not enjoying all the trappings and the making all the money, all he really wants to do is A, stay out of prison himself, B, make sure that he's got the financial legacy to ensure that future generations of his family are looked after and that there's no sort of, you know, regulatory stuff like he, you know, banned from practicing business or, you know, his companies, his family's legacy, if you like, are banned from carrying on business in any particular state. I suspect there's not a huge list of things that you would need to tick to get him to move off the stage. You know, with all the caveats, and it's, you know, I've done all the hard work. I've got this country back on its feet, and you know, it's the hottest country in the world. Now I can leave it to some other underling to sort of do the easy bit of keeping it all going. You know, there'll be that kind of bullshit, but. I suspect people like Murdoch will be thinking about how they can start writing that scene.
Do you think, Liz, he's got a chance of winning the midterms?
I'm not really in tune with, I mean, it might have been people that have been following me for, it might be fairly obvious that I'm not somebody that's really interested in America. I feel I'm a European, and so I don't follow American politics particularly. But I find it hard to imagine that he would win, given that his base have been fractured by the Epstein scandal. And this morning, actually, I actually thought, why did the Democrats not go more on Epstein pre-election? Because it really is his Achilles heel. And I don't remember much mention of Epstein in the lead up to the last election. So that's one for, to sort of chew over. But now, obviously, the Democrats know that it's a massive hot issue, and they're going to keep squeezing and squeezing that. And that directly impacts Trump, which is obviously why he no longer knows Mandelson, because Mandelson's been taken out by Epstein. And it's contagious. So I will watch with interest to see what happens. But I think from our perspective, which is where I always look at it, and I'm particularly focused on the American deal and what that means for our food and standards, and also our hopes of ever rejoining the European Union, are really that the more delay we get, the better. And the appeal court has challenged the tariffs in America, and I know they're trying to expedite it, but the Supreme Court, as I understand it, is so slow that there will not be a ruling on that until next year. I mean, Mark can probably knows more about this than me. But from our perspective, it's very hard for them to hammer through that deal. Even though Starmer's actually done it using statutory instrument, I don't know what you do when you've ingested something like an illegal trade deal into your legislature using Henry VIII's powers. I don't know what that does. And that ingesting of that American deal is going to cause problems with the TCA, and it definitely causes problems for Northern Ireland. So perhaps we'll just hope, perhaps they will continue hoping that there'll be some sort of mass vaccination program that will save them from some sort of burst out of the illegal trade deal in there. I don't know. Or that if the Supreme Court find that the tariffs are illegal, perhaps it will destroy that trade deal as we see it. We'll have to wait and see. But the trade deal is the most important issue for me at the moment.
As someone with an American wife and therefore half a family over there, I don't have the luxury that Liz has of switching off from US politics. But what that also means is that I do take a reasonable interest, and I do hear things, through the media, but also from individuals on the ground. And one of the things that's most striking is that ordinary people are starting to see the indirect consequences of Trump and his agenda. And, people struggling to get healthcare for elderly relatives, people's bills going up, people seeing businesses suffering because of the trade environment. And I think that's the bit that's really difficult to control, because oftentimes politicians and media figures have power because they're able to talk about things at an abstract level, and people engage with it at that abstract level. But abstract discussions never win over real world, in your face, this is what I feel every single minute of the day. And I think that's going to be quite an issue for him, because he can say whatever he wants at that point. There will be people saying, "Yeah, I hear you, but that's not my life. That's not how it's playing out for me."
Well, I find just to only a slight final note on the Epstein thing, because the head of the FBI, Kash Patel, was put up in front of Congress and got torn a new one. And it was interesting, like, there's overlap, like, Epstein. The co-conspirator is English. Like, it's not, and they traffic people to Britain. Like, and we've got photographic evidence, and we've got eyewitness accounts, and there's apparently 20 different men implicated at the congressional hearing. They didn't list the names, they listed what their jobs were, which was very telling. So they obviously can't get in trouble for doing that, and they can't really alert them. But they were saying, yeah, it's a business mogul, it's a tech company owner, and you're going, wow. And they're saying some of the richest people in the world are involved in this, and you're going, who is on that list? And I think we have a few ideas. You mentioned the Democrats. I think they're terrified about the Clintons. The implication of that would be devastating to both parties, and you'll probably have a third party spring up. And then just to finish up, Patel had a car crash. he was asked, is Trump's name in the files like 1,000 times? And he originally said, I don't know how many times. And then they said, is it in there 1,000 times? I don't know. And then they pushed him. And then they were like, yes, so it is 1,000 times. It's not 1,000 times. And then they went 500 times. No, it's not 500 times. And then he went 100 times. It's not 100 times. And then they're going, so you do know the number. You're like, wow, you fucking moron. Then he got pulled up and he said, did you talk to the attorney general about Trump being in the files? Remember, you're under oath as the head of the FBI. Would not answer. He definitively said he never spoke to Trump, but he wouldn't answer about talking to the attorney general. Then he was asked, are you going to meet with the victims? And he said, no, I won't. Then they pulled him up and said, are you aware of a journalist called Wolf who's got tapes, like a stack of tapes from his interviews with Epstein? Oh, I didn't know that existed. And you're like, are you...
He's only the head of the FBI. How would he know about that?
How would he know about that? And all he said was, well, we're getting rid of other people. And it's like, yes, but there's like 20 very powerful people. But just to really hammer home on that, he claimed there was no evidence that anyone was trafficked to anyone. They all just went to Epstein. And you're going, there's Virginia Roberts with a photo saying she was trafficked to this bloke. And you're saying there's no evidence. And you're going, are you nuts? And of course, Congress got very rampant over that and basically said, you're protecting the elite. Members of Congress said, you're protecting powerful people. You're protecting people. And he said, that may be the most offensive thing anyone's ever said to me. And you go, maybe? Maybe that is? What do you want? So tie-in here is obviously Andrew was dropped. Congress people were saying about Andrew being involved. And of course, and Mandelson's now involved, and you're going, there's no talk about this in the UK press. It is compared to America. And yet we know people were brought here and the co-conspirator is English. And you're going, this is crazy that you're not willing to investigate it. And you're going, right, you're clearly hiding something. That's why. And either you're protecting the monarchy or there's more to it and there's more British people involved that are very influential. Those are the only two conclusions I can come up with as to why the UK press and the government do not want to deal with this. So just to flip this back at you both, Starmer's woes, do you think he can turn it around? Because I think this could end up going back on his plate. And I think the press and the government are just going to try and ignore it. And we've seen that didn't work with Mandelson. And in fact, that just continued to break that. I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back with a lot of the public. I think Starmer's ratings are now the lowest in Europe. The lowest in Europe. I think it's lower than Rishi Sunak. Jesus, that is a huge thing. So I'll throw it over to both of you. Do you think, with all these woes, including Epstein now and appointing Mandelson, do you think there's a chance that Starmer can turn this around, Mark? Liz's answer is just straight no. What do you think, Mark?
There's always a chance. And in this world that we live in, you'd be a fool to rule anything out. But you take a step back and just sort of coldly and soberly assess the degree, the type of challenges, the breadth of challenges and the depths of those challenges, then I think, you know, it's debatable, I think, is the most, the fairest way of putting it. Look, I think the difficulty is he's got problems inside his team within Number 10. They're just not getting the calls right. When I was working in the Cabinet Office, I remember people like Alistair Campbell being criticised for being too in control of the media narrative and you know, being overly professional at that sort of stuff. And now I think, you know, the opposite is true. They don't control the narrative. They're not responding to the narrative that they're not in control of in the right way. And everything starts with the people in the immediate orbit around Starmer. If that's not right, everything else has got potential to be less effective. I think they made some mistakes with the civil service in the early days and played into this, you know, the civil servants are the problems, are the problem. And I think that's really unhelpful, because whenever you tell people that, whenever they can see something that might help you out, they may or may not alert you to it. So that's just human nature. I think the deputy leadership thing now has opened a whole new significant can of worms. Mm-hmm. That has prompted more debate about the general direction of the party, and specifically about the agenda that Starmer has and about the way he goes about things. And that's, in, trying to keep all of those cats herded in a controllable way is impossible. So look, I think, and you know, the general political backdrop, the economy and the rise of Nigel Farage and all the rest of it means he's just playing in a really hostile environment. I think if he doesn't make a really groundbreaking, truly exceptional speech at conference, and the rest of the conference doesn't sort of fall into line with that, you know, even making a really good speech in the middle of a dumpster fire, as the Americans say, won't do it. I think it has to be both of those things. And then I think the budget has to be, you know, a thing that avoids alienating any significant part of society. Again, brackets, not sure how they're going to do that. And then I think the period between then and the run into the locals and the devolved administration elections next year will be really, really rocky for him.
Yes. Liz?
No, I don't think he's going to make it back. And the basic reason for that is that he just hasn't got a personality. I think, you know, Thatcher went through a difficult time in her first 18 months. And the reason she came back is because she learned to speak properly. She lowered her voice and she became a stronger personality. And Starmer is not able to change that. Also, in Thatcher's day, there weren't cameras on you 24/7 as there are now. And I don't think he's got the ability to change the way he looks and the way he acts. And so I don't think that the British public will learn to love Starmer, or a proportion of the British public, because many will never love him. So I think that's a problem for him. Also, I don't think they're prepared to change their agenda. They still want to get rid of welfare. And so he's going to continually to hit the rocks with his own party. And Andy Burnham is on the rise. And with the deputy leadership, that is the direction of travel. And they're trying to throw things at Andy and push, you know, and to try and make it look as if he's never going to make it. But ultimately, our elections are more presidential than ever. And I think the only person that is, you know, if I was a Labour MP, I would be looking at them thinking, Starmer's done, he hasn't got it. He's done what power wants. I mean, wealthy power. And he continues to do what wealthy power wants, thinking that he's going to somehow redeem it. But I think they will. And as Mark said, with the elections coming up next year, I just think it's an absolute no way. And he cannot separate himself from Morgan McSweeney and Maurice Glassman. They are absolutely shackled together. And so the only way he could redeem any trust with his party is by ditching Morgan. And he's not going to do that. And the answer to that is because Morgan McSweeney is obviously very, very close with Rupert Murdoch. I think he is destined for the bin. Yeah.
Before the election, or he'll fall into the bin after the election?
Oh, I think he'll go in the bin before the election. And the other interesting thing I learned last week from Sam Coates, I didn't know this, but Starmer last year changed the rules on how to evict a Labour Prime Minister. And now it only needs 80 MPs to get behind a candidate. And before, it was a very complicated... And he changed the rules because he was concerned about union power. And in doing so, he's provided an opportunity for those MPs who we saw rebel against welfare. And the reason they've done that is obviously that there are... And this is the other reason why, actually, I don't completely regret feeling behind Labour. I've always voted Labour, apart from a few years around Brexit for the Lib Dems, is that there are people in the party with proper values around the post-war settlement, which I feel very attached to. I do believe that we're better off to have a country which at least ensures that there is a system that looks after the weakest in society. I do not want to be like America. And that's ultimately what the decision has always been about Brexit. Do we want to be like America, or do we want to be, a social democracy that provides a safety net for people? And I will always come down on the post-war settlement. That is definitely the best way forward. The survival of the richest is not a good system.
It's funny because I always sort of found it odd that people thought he was going to be quite socialist when he was a public prosecutor whose sole aim is to bang people up. Not that shocking. But the four key issues, if he's going to get them fixed, would be cost of living, the NHS, housing, and now immigration. And if he could do that, and then cost of living I'd include with the economy, because the two do go hand in hand. If he can get those four things done, and he's now only got, what, three years to do it?
That, Al, is the problem. Some rules of thumb that we used to have in government, you have to say things about 10 times before you can start to make assumptions that people have stood a chance of hearing you, and you need to have said them in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Starmer's natural communication skills are not like Tony Blair's. They're not Donald Trump's. They're not Emmanuel Macron's. He doesn't have that ability to just really send out a powerful message that people immediately register. So he's on a downer on that. And the other thing is, the other rule of thumb was, whenever you make a good change in government policy, you can kind of expect it to take 18 months before people actually start to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a little bit simplistic to say, but you put some money in someone's pocket, they don't really start appreciating that for about a year, 18 months afterwards. So your point about, even if he turned this thing on a dime, you know, turns the tanker on a dime, which is an impossible task, but even if he was able to do that, we're getting perilously close to the next election by then. So the odds are genuinely stacked against him.
I don't see it. I think, Liz, you tweeted this morning or last night, he made that claim, oh, I got 150 billion out of the US in investment. And you're going, yeah, but you lost 700 million from Brexit.
And we're continuing to, you know, the black. This is the saddest thing, that if he wanted to succeed, had he come in and actually really pushed towards Europe and gave them a great state visit, and we actually repaired Brexit, whether that's through an EFTA model or whatever, if he'd done that, the economy would be flying, our continent would be a lot safer, and the world would be a better place. But he decided to go with the hardest route, which is trying to make us more like America.
But another element, Al, why I say, you know, never rule it out, is... Mm. You know, one of the things I think he has done really well is deal with the Russia-Ukraine situation. You know, he's been a figurehead on that. He's dealt with it in a quite a determined way. He's been giving Ukrainians weaponry that they've asked for, training for their F-16 pilots. All of that stuff is really positive. And at the moment, that's just one sort of facet of everything that he does. If, you know, these developments we're seeing in Eastern Europe continue to progress, and Putin does decide that he's in a corner, he's the rat in the corner now, and he decides to tip the table and just go for bust by doing something really rash, then that whole thing moves center stage, and that then changes the calculus about, you know, well, maybe this guy is all right. You know, you got all, as Boris Johnson's people tried to say in his last days, at least he got all the big questions right, you know. There's a little bit to that. Say again, sorry?
Having parties.
Yeah,
big thing got right,
yeah. But you know, that's one of the reasons why I think we shouldn't sort of write him off 100%, even if we accept that the odds are significantly stacked against him.
You see, that reminds me of there's a couple of things to tie in there. Events, dear boy, events.
Exactly.
And Falklands War. 100%. And it was really interesting this week watching how Donald Trump had the Charlie Kirk incident assassination, and it pushed everything back in his favor. Like when he was, it felt very similar in so many respects to when he had the assassination attempt and then got up and just propagandized it to hell with that fist pump and the shot with the American flag underneath. And you're like, wow, what a twist. But then he fires Jimmy Kimmel and it's huge pushback. And you're going, geez, like, and I get it's, to me, history, Putin, Mussolini, Hitler, it's knocking out your opponents using the government state to do that. That's what he's done with the FCC. I don't think we've got time to go into the details of that. But I think you're right. There is always a chance. You never know what's around the corner. You know, maybe someone will take a pop at Starmer and then he'll get another push in the ratings, or we'll have war like Thatcher did she had the Falklands that gave her that popularity boost and she won it. If she'd lost it, then she wouldn't. And, you know, there were the odd chance that Thatcher could have lost that. I think he's done well with NHS. I think it's hard to not say it, but it's almost getting it back to the standard of what it was before COVID, not to what it was when Labour and Blair were in charge of it, where it was exceptionally good. I don't think he's going to fix housing. If he tackles immigration and puts people off coming here, 500,000 left again last year. No one's talking about that. Birth rate dropped again this month to 1.41. It needs to be at 2.4 if you want to have a pension system, capitalist system. And if you want that, we have a labor shortage and people are saying we don't want more people here. And you're going, okay, that is not going to work. So set up a birth policy, but that will take 10 to 20 years before you start to see any effect. And then cost of living, Brexit. He's not going to reverse on that. I don't see any other way of resolving the cost of living crisis. Not with what we've got in terms of materials, land size, farming, etc. So I'm going, and housing, you know what I'm going to say, it's 3D printing. But they won't implement it here because houses are an asset and they don't want to devalue them because you might have an economic crash with mortgages, banking, etc. So he hasn't got many levers, and the ones that he's pulling on are the worst ones. Like that. So unless, as you said,
Mark, I think that the immigration, thing they're using as a campaign tool and it's really horrible, actually. It really is nasty. They want it to be the biggest issue, to push out everything else. They want people to be scared, to feel fearful of people coming over here, causing crime. And, you know, they want immigrants to be seen as the cause of Britain's decline. And that comes directly from Maurice Glassman and his ideology, which is what I said. For Starmer to succeed, for me, someone like me to like him, he needs to ditch McSweeney and ditch Blue Labour and Maurice Glassman's awful rhetoric and ideology. And I don't see any sign of that. And that is where Glassman is joined at the hip with Trump and Vance. And that is that's the problem. So I think if Starmer decided to try and survive, he'd have to separate from those guys. I don't think he can. So we are stuck with what we've got. So my hope is at the moment built in Andy Burnham managing to find a seat and get elected and hopefully sweeping through and with over 80 MPs, with Lucy Powell is looking the clear favourite to win the deputy PM, and that they have got enough gravitas and personal values to not get into power and then start saying the opposite of what they promised before they got into power.
There is a by-election in Manchester, but we haven't got time to talk about that today. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As awesome as ever. Thank you, everyone. Bye. Hail the lamp.
Hail lamp. Bye. See you soon.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Your dark choices for today. You've got a choice to import into Britain, and you've got to pick one. Do you import chlorinated chicken from the US or hormone-injected beef from Australia?
Well, that's my choice.
In this new world, apocalyptic, you've got those two choices. You can only have one.
Well, we've already got beef coming from Australia. And because we don't do any checks, I would say we've probably already got hormone-fed beef here. And so I'll go with hormone-fed beef.
Choice, environmental disaster. Steroids going in and destroying the environment.
No, but chlorinated chicken is horrendous. It's the reason it's chlorinated is because the conditions that the animals are kept in. Hormones are really bad. They're carcinogenic. They're also really bad for the animals because they grow quicker than their legs can hold them in many cases. But I'm really thinking about it from a trade perspective. We've already got a trade deal with Australia, so I'll go with that one because the chlorinated chicken is just the beginning of something really nasty.
Mark, your choices are, you're stuck in the lift. The lift move, you're trying to get to the top floor. In comes one of two, Nigel Farage or Liz Truss, who do you have in the lift with you?
Definitely Nigel Farage out of those two. That's an easy one. I say that because I think at least you could have an interesting conversation with Farage.
That's true. Liz Truss would actually, by the end of that lift tour, you'd be insane.
Yeah, he'd be full of... Both of them are quite conspiratorial, though. Liz Truss is saying in the inner state, but you listen to Farage and break down some of the stuff. He's quite a conspiracy theorist as well, which is quite interesting between the two.
Having met Nigel a few times, if I had to pick someone to sit next to at dinner out of a group, I wouldn't be like, oh, no. He's fairly easy to talk to as a person. It doesn't mean to say you have to agree with him, but yeah, Liz exactly. Truss is definitely would be like inviting worms into your brain.
The lift goes up, and now you have a choice between Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson. Who do you let in?
Who are you asking that? Mark?
It's all Mark.
I'd probably choose Bojo out of those two. Because he's the one that I'd most like to pin down and tell a few things to. Rees-Mogg I don't like him. He's from a different era. His value set and his perspective on life are totally alien to me. But he's nowhere near as consequential as Boris Johnson was. And indeed, I think, you know, possibly could be again in the future.
The lift goes up one more floor. Donald Trump or Elon Musk, who do you let in?
Musk. Yeah.
Any reason?
Because I think he's the lunatic on the ascendancy. I think Trump's, you know, he's there right now. He's at the heart of things, but he's an old man. He doesn't appear to be in the best of health, and his impact on the world will be, you know, what it will be. I think Musk has got a lot of potential to be a lot more damaging than he has already been. Just the, you know, the intervention that he made at the Tommy Robinson rally last weekend, I think is a sort of illustration of that. This is the second richest man in the world, and he clearly has no problem at all identifying with ideas that were popularized by Nazis. And he's, what is he, 50 years old? I don't know how old he is. He's not 80. And he is in charge of a number of companies that are at the very heart of sort of everyday life. Communications, social media, transportation, space travel, which includes satellites, which includes how countries might go to war. You know, the fact that you have a single man capable of making a decision about whether or not the Ukrainians can continue to communicate effectively with their front lines is a measure of the potential impact that man has. So yeah,
the Batman baddie.
He is the Batman baddie, isn't he? Okay, on that note, bye.
Thanks, Alex.